This is Audible.
Canongate Books presents Sal by Mick Kitson, read for you by Sharon Rooney. Chapter 1. Snares. Peppa said cold, and then she went quiet for a bit. And then she said, "Cold, Sal. I'm cold." Her voice was low and quiet and whispery, not like normal. I started to worry she had hypothermia. I saw a thing about how it makes you go all slow and quiet. So I felt down and her back was warm, and her belly was warm. And then she went, "Stop lazing us, you pedo." And then I knew she didn't have hypothermia. But it was cold. The coldest night since we came here. I knew the wind had turned to the north from a compass, and the shelter faced southeast because west is in the prevailing wind here. So the wind was coming in the top where we'd laid on the spruce branches. Peppa didn't have a hat. I was going to make her one once we'd snared rabbits. But I hadn't put the snares out yet. I pulled off my hat and pushed it down onto her head. "Is that better?" I whispered in her little ear. But she'd gone back to sleep. I was awake now and I started worrying for a bit. I used to time worrying by the clock on my phone. I did 10 minutes most mornings, but it had gone up in the past few weeks because there was a lot to work out and plan before we ran. I was going to guess the time. I could feel it was nearly dawn. There was no light, but I could feel something. I can nearly always tell what time it is. I don't know how, but it used to be important to know it. Because, for instance, Ma and Robert used to come back at just after 11, and after I'd fitted the lock on Peppa's door, I used to make sure it was locked and she was inside asleep just before they got back. They didn't even know I put the lock on it. Didn't know I'd nicked a mini drill and two chisels from B&Q. I snipped the alarm tags off with a nail clipper. I bought a sash lock in the big Asda and watched 5 YouTube videos before I fitted it. They didn't even notice the wee holes I drilled in for the key. The paint on the doors in our flat was all scuffed and knocked anyway. Then Peppa had the key. Robert couldn't get in if he tried. He never tried. If I'd put a lock on my door, Robert would have kicked it in and woken Peppa. He wouldn't have woken Ma, because when she was drunk and she passed out, he couldn't wake her. And he hadn't started going in Peppa's room then. But I knew he would soon because he said he would. And Peppa was 10, and that was when he started on me. So I thought I'd have 10 minutes worrying. I knew it would start getting light soon. In the SAS Survival Handbook, it says you should make a body-length fire along a lean-to shelter and then build a barrier behind it from sticks to deflect the heat. I hadn't done that yet because I wasn't sure this was where we were staying just then. But it was all right. It was a little flat raised bit above the burn and there were big birches all around. We'd tied the tarp up to 2 of them to make the shelter. The tarp was camouflage brown and beige and bits of yellowy white, like for deserts. But it worked, because I ran back away from it into the woods and looked down between the trees, and you couldn't see it. Except you knew someone was there because I could hear Pepper yelling, "Sal, come and get a look at this." It was a toad, and she stroked it. And I said, "Its poison's on its back to stop predators eating it." And she said, "I'm not going to eat it, Sal. Can you eat it?" "I don't want to eat it. I'm going to build it a house." And then she made a little house out of flat stones and pebbles and put the toad in it. She said it was called Connor after a boy she liked at school. I worried about fire and people seeing it. Not so much in the day, but at night. If your wood's dry, there isn't a lot of smoke from a small pyramid fire. It's just smoky if the wood is wet or too new. And also, the wind blows it away. And also, we were in the last great wilderness in the UK, and we were exactly 8 miles from the nearest human habitation, and roughly 4 miles from a forestry track, and 5 miles from a road. I chose this place very carefully, using an ordnance survey map I nicked from the library, where they have all the ordnance survey maps of the British Isles. We were exactly 0.5 mile into the forest behind a ridge that runs up towards the top, where it's just under 3,000 feet. In fact, another 28 feet and it would be a Monroe, and there would be all the climbers and wankers and cagoules going up it. There are no trees at the top, but according to the map there is a stone circle. The hill is called something in Gaelic, and when I asked Mrs. Kerr, she said it was pronounced Magna Bra. Magna Bra. I told Peppa, and she wanted to go there because I told her Magna means big in Latin, and she was delighted and skipped about going, Big Bra, huh? Big Bra. She is a dirty-minded wee bastard, and she wants to watch her swearing. But at night, you could see the fire glow away off. Not on the tart side, but on the other side. So I thought, if I build the barrier they talk about in the handbook, it would block the light at night from the east. I don't know what way they'd come if they came out here and looked for us, but they might come from the east. The motorway is east of us, and they'd use that if they came out here. But I don't see how they can, or how they'll know we are here. I decided after my worry to make the barrier today and set the snares. We'd got enough food for another 2 days, I thought. Or three if I don't eat and Peppa does. So we needed to start trapping and hunting. I had Robert's air gun. It was short and you pump it up. It shot 0.22 pellets and I got 2 tins of them. I wouldn't let Peppa use it yet in case she shot herself, or me, by accident. But I am a good shot. I practised in the hall of the flat, and I worked out the way to adjust the sight of the parabolum at longer ranges. I watched a YouTube video about it too, 3 days before we left. On 7 pumps, it can go through a bit of 9mm plywood. I brought it there in a zip-up hockey stick case I found in the school changing rooms. It was getting light. In October here, that means it was just about 7:20 a.m. Peppa slept in the bag and I hauled myself out so as not to wake her. The leaves that had fallen were light yellow and they shone as the daylight came through the trees. The birch trees shone too. Birch is white and it would be good for the barrier because white reflects light and heat. I blew the embers back and fed in some little sticks with burny ends. I put a stack to dry on a flat stone overnight too, and once it took, I built a pyramid over it. It hissed and smoked, and I got the steel frame and put it over, and then put the little kettle on it to boil. We had tea bags and UHT milk and sugar in the tubes from McDonald's. Loads of them. The sun was up now, and it was bright through the trees, and steam was lifting off the wood floor in little white wisps. There were wee sparkles of frost on the leaf edges and twigs, and the wind had dropped so the smoke went straight up between the trees. It was still. Just the whoosh sound of the fire. Then I could hear birds and squawks of crows. Nothing else. No rumble of a road or traffic or wheels. No banging or bleeping. No telly. Nobody shouting. I had 4 snares made from twisted wire with little gold rings where the wire made a noose and green cord to a wooden peg with a notch in it. You set them in runs where rabbits went and left them overnight. I had seen it done on YouTube on a survival site. It looked easy and the rabbit was dead when you went back. But I wouldn't mind killing one. I had never killed one. Or anything apart from Robert. It said you should bury them for a few hours to get the human smell off them. So I scraped back the leaves and got them out of Peppa's backpack and covered them up. I bought them in a fishing tackle shop in town with the money I got from one of Robert's cards. Robert always had cards when he came back from wherever he went off to. I used to nick them when he was asleep drunk. The thing about Ma and Robert was they never noticed anything. If something changed or moved, they didn't even know. I knew where everything was in my room and the rest of the flat. I knew how many cups we had, how many spoons. I knew how much milk there was and how much washing up liquid. I noted it all the time. I'd done it from a baby. I noticed what things were and where they were, and I noticed when they moved or changed or went. Ma and Robert didn't see anything. Ma was worst. Even her cans. She never knew how many she had left. I did. I used to hide them and she'd not even notice there were only 2 instead of 3 in the fridge. Sometimes, if she just had 2, she was all right. I noticed that years before, so I'd hide a couple and just leave her two. And then when she came round and wanted one, I'd say, "You've only got two left." And she'd go, "I thought I had a four-pack." And I'd go, "Well, you must have drunk them." And she'd say, "Aye." When Peppa started nicking her fags, she didn't notice either. Robert noticed nothing either, because he was mostly drunk, or on weed, or both. And even though he stared really hard and long at things, he never noticed if something was missing, or if I'd moved something, or bought something. Robert's eyes were always half closed like he was squinting, and they were always red from weed and bevy. The little bit of white you could see was yellow. The tarp and the hunting knife and the kettle frame and even Peppa's walking trainers all came in the post. All got on Amazon, all with nicked cards Robert brought back with him and kept in the bedside drawer. I was careful when I was nicking the cards or lifting his wallet. Once he was out of it, lying on the sofa, I tried to pull it out of his back pocket and he half woke up and grabbed me and went, "I'll cut your fucking hands off." And then he flopped back to sleep and I got it then. The only thing he did keep his eye on was me. "All right, my darling," he used to say. He once said I was his daughter to a guy in the chippy. I wanted to say, "I'm fucking not." But he was giving it the big man and he had his arm around my shoulders and going, "This is my lassie, Sal." If I'd said anything, he'd make it worse later, so I just shut up and stared at the guy. Peppa woke up and said, "Is Connor still there, Sal?" And I went over and lifted the stone on his house, and he was. It was nice and damp under there for him in the leaves and muck. Peppa said, "Brilliant!" and jumped out of the sleeping bag and started putting on her shoes. They were £84 on Amazon, and they've got Vibram soles, which are the best for walking and climbing. Peppa can run faster than anyone in the world, I think. She's got really long legs, and she looks like wind running along. She was faster than any boy at school, even boys older than her. In fact, she does everything fast. She is either still like a stone or going really fast. She eats fast, and she talks fast. And Peppa will eat anything, and she is always hungry. When we were wee, we were hungry a lot because Ma was out drunk or we had no money and Peppa used to go to other flats around the close and ask for food. She learned to eat anything, not like most kids who hate salad and only want chips. But Peppa used to beg for chips at the chippy and ask kids at school for food and teachers. And in the end, I told her to stop. And I had to get her food, because if they told, the social would come round and take us. The social took kids all the time, and they always split them up. So I didn't say anything to anyone, and Ma warned us we'd get took and split up. So I nicked food for her, a lot. And I got her bags of salad and carrots, and once some beetroot in a plastic bag that was cooked, and she loved it. And she stopped begging for food, and nobody told the social on us. And when Robert started on me, he said if I told, even if I told Ma, we'd get took and split up. He said Peppa would get fostered and adopted by Africans because she is half an African, and I'd get adopted by old people, and we wouldn't be together. And that is never going to happen. So it is good for surviving if you will eat anything like Peppa, but not if you are hungry all the time like her. And she said, "Oh, I'm starving, Sal." And I gave her some Dundee cake and four Belvita biscuits and I said, "We're going to snare some rabbits." And she said, "To eat?" And I said, "Aye." And she said, "Good." She had a look at Connor under the stones and picked him up and he sat in her hand and she talked to him. She told him her name and my name and where we came from and why we were in the woods. Then she put him back in the house and got her Helly Hansen on. Rabbits don't hibernate, and there are loads in the Galloway Forest, and they mostly live in warrens at the foot of hills and slopes where there is scrubby ground covered in grass. Grass is the thing they eat most, and not carrots or lettuce like Peter Rabbit on the telly. It was autumn, and most sites said they would be active, and you had to look for runs in the grass to set the snares. I had never set a snare, or gutted a rabbit, or skinned one, but I had seen it done loads of times on YouTube. I got the snares out from the leaves and mud, and I put them in the pocket of my coat. I had my knife and a sheath on my belt. We walked down from our shelter along the burn, and climbed over it on rocks, and then up a slope where the trees were thinner, and there was grass and ferns. Pepper ran. The ferns were turning brown, but they still stuck up high, and she was lost in them, and then I'd see her red hair shoot by in a gap. I watched the ground looking for runs. There were paths there made by animals, and I saw prints of deer in the mud and other prints I needed to check later in the SES survival handbook. We walked up until it came level, and then beyond was another long slope down towards the lock right at the bottom. Peppa tore down the slope, and I wanted to stop her from frightening anything, but when she was running like that, you couldn't stop her. I had seen her tear away like that before, leaping over logs and fern stumps, running and swift and smooth, like she was on wheels. And then she stopped dead halfway down and shouted, "Sal!" I came down towards her where the trees had thinned out, mostly old birch and oak, some with big branches thicker than me that hung down to the grass. She was by a big grey rock that poked up out the grass, and she was pointing down in front of it. "Look," she said. It was rabbit holes, three of them with droppings all around. And when I looked, I saw more. Some of them were further back up towards an oak tree, and the holes were covered by fringes of grass. There were nine of them in total. Some were disused with no droppings, and some had fresh dark mud and piles outside where they had been digging out. I could see the runs going away from the holes, little lighter coloured dents running along the grass. They mostly went down the slope towards the lock. The further you got down, the greener and thicker the grass got, and less trees and ferns. "It's a warren," I said. "Set the snares then," said Peppa. "You can't set snares by the warren. They'll go round them." Bear Grylls said you have to walk away from the warren, along a run, and set the snares away. "I saw that one, Sal, and he didn't even get one. He had to buy a rabbit to cook." "Wanker," she said. She was right, but he still knows what he's on about, because he was in the SAS and he has survived everywhere. And he jumps into bogs and frozen lakes, even if he doesn't need to. But he is a wanker, but that is most probably because he is posh in English. Most of the survival people on the telly are posh in English, like Ray Mears and Ed Stafford, and most posh English people are wankers. But I had got a Bear Grylls knife off Amazon, and it was brilliant. The same one he used, with a full tang. "Don't call Bear a wanker, Peppa," I said. And she went, "Wanker," again, and ran off down the slope. I picked a run and followed it through more brown bracken. I kept looking back to the rock, and approximately 50 metres down, I came to a bit where there was just grass. And it was that velvety, thick, bladed grass that is light green, and the run went straight through the middle of it. Then I heard Peppa shout, "Rabbit!" And she was running back up to me, chasing one. It smashed up through the ferns and into the clearing where I was, with Peppa almost on it, but it turned sharp when it saw me. Peppa had the face on she always has when she's running, like she's biting her bottom lip and pushing her tongue out under her lip. When the rabbit swerved, she tried to change direction, and she was going so fast she toppled and rolled into the bracken, and it cracked and hissed. "Bastard," she said. I said, "Run up to that tree and get some twigs," and she took off towards the oak. You need twigs to hold the snare open on the run, and you have to set it a hand's width above the ground so it is in line with the rabbit's head. I got the first snare out and rubbed a bit of mud on it to mask the human smell. But rabbits don't have a really keen sense of smell like rats or moles. They have good hearing, and they communicate by thumping the ground to warn each other. They also have good eyesight, so I wrapped long strands of grass around the shiny brass to make it more camouflaged. Peppa ran back down with the twigs, and I pushed them into the ground and set the snare open across the width of the run and then hammered in the peg with the butt of my knife. Peppa said, "Will that get one?" And I said, "Aye, it will. We'll have to leave it overnight, but it will get one." And I believed it would. Because if you believe something will happen, then it does. So you have to be careful about what you believe will happen. I believed that I would stop Robert and make Ma safe for nearly a year. And then I did. We set three more snares. One on the run we'd followed further down, and then two more on another run that went parallel to the loch at the bottom. Then we went out wide of the area where I thought the rabbits were, so we didn't scare them back down the slope to the loch. Peppa said, "Let's go down to the loch," and she started running down through the ferns and trees towards the water. I tried to estimate how far I was from the loch in metres. I estimated it was nearly 70 metres, and I knew my stride was 90 centimetres because I had measured it. So I worked out that if I took 77 strides going straight down, it was more or less 70 metres. You divide 7,000 centimetres by 90, and that is approximately 77.7. This is one of the things I learned to do. Estimate distance. And I am good at maths, and I know times tables and how to divide in my mind. So if I need to, I can work out how far away something is, or how long it will take to get to me, and that is important for survival. I did 77 strides straight down and got to the loch side and the little beach of flat stones. And the water was about 50 centimetres from where I stopped, so that wasn't bad. The loch was long and turned a corner, so from the beach you couldn't see the end like you could up on the slope. Trees came all the way down to the water, all around, except on the bit we were. There was a little beach. And because of the angle of the slope behind me, I estimated the depth to be about a metre and a half deep, 3 metres out. But you can't really tell for sure, because there could be holes or gullies in the rock under the water which would make it deeper. It was flat, calm and still. The north breeze had dropped from this morning, and the water was like a sheet of glass or highly polished steel. You could see it was yellow-brown in colour, but clear quite far out, because there had been no substantial rain in this area for close to 3 weeks. I had checked every day before we came. Peppa was balancing about 3 metres out on a rock she'd jumped to from some little stepping stones that went out from the beach. "Don't get your trainers wet, Peppa," I said. "All right. Hey, Sal, I can see fish here. Wee stripy ones." She could actually get her trainers wet, because they were made of Gore-Tex, which is both waterproof and breathable. But if water got in over the top, we'd have to dry them out on the fire, or they would be too dangerous to wear for too long and cause athlete's foot and other fungal infections. We had to be careful about infections. I had told her this. Even wee cuts and grazes, because I only had 4 amoxicillin tablets, which I found in the bathroom cabinet. In my first aid kit, I had plasters, iodine, cotton wool, 2 bandages, safety pins, scissors, Savlon cream and some antidepressants called citalopram 30. I thought they might come in handy if Peppa got depressed like Ma. They never seemed to do Ma any good, but that might be because she was drunk so much they probably didn't work. Like, you can't mix antibiotics with alcohol because the alcohol stops the antibiotics from killing bacteria which causes infections. We didn't have any alcohol, and we weren't going to get any, even for medicinal purposes. I also had some paracetamol and ibuprofen and codeine, which is the best painkiller available without a prescription, in case we got hurt or got a sprain or a twisted ankle, or I got my period and I got period pain. We did periods in P6, and I am 13, which is the age they said you mostly started getting them. I hadn't got it yet, but planning for potential problems is an important part of survival. Also, we could use sphagnum moss, which was everywhere, as an antiseptic on wounds like they did in the First World War. The wee fish were perch. The loch is called something in Gaelic, like Dubna Da, and it contains pike, perch, brown trout and eels. We were going to fish for all of these with the rod and reel I nicked off Robert. He most likely nicked it anyway. It was a 10-foot telescopic spinning rod with a screw reel seat, and the reel was a thick spool Shimano loaded with a 10-pound line. I had other fishing stuff too. Size 10 and 12 hooks, BB split shot and some small trout spinners, and lures in a plastic pack I nicked from the tackle shop. I also had two pike plugs and three wire traces, which you need for pike to stop them biting through the line. Robert sometimes went down to the wall in the summer to spin for mackerel, and he once brought three back and more shrieked, and he didn't know how to gut them or cook them, and he just stood there waving them about with more shrieking and going, "Fuck off with them, Robert!" So I watched a YouTube and then gutted and baked them with salt, and me and Peppa ate them while Ma and Robert were at the fisherman's. And they were lovely and tasted sweet. The sun was fully up now and it was warm on us, and Peppa skipped across the stones to the beach and unzipped her heli Hansen and chucked it down on the rocks, and then jumped up onto the grass and started pulling at it and overturning wee rocks and stones. She is nearly as tall as me, and she is only 10, and her skin is the colour of dark honey, and in the sun it looks gold. Her hair is frizzy and afro and ginger, and she has freckles. I think she will be very, very beautiful when she is a woman. Her teeth are very white, and she loves cleaning them and biting things with them. She bit Robert's hand once when he was hitting Ma, and he backhanded her across the room and called her a wee cunt, and I jumped on her to stop him hitting her again, and he kicked me in the back twice, and I had a bruise that went purple, then yellow, and I was off school again. I was off school a lot, and I worried they'd send the plunky man to get me to go, but they never. Our flat was on the second floor of Linlithgow House. There are three blocks all named after royal palaces, on a hill above town, and you can see the wall and the sea from the balcony. The other blocks around the court are Falkland and Scone. The entry phone lock was knackered in ours, so you just shoved the bottom door with your shoulder. The hall was light blue and smelled of piss, and junkies sometimes slept under the first set of concrete stairs going up. Peppa stopped crying the same time as I did, when she was about 8, and neither of us have cried since then. If she's angry, she looks down and bites her bottom lip like she does when she's running, and if she is sad, I make a cradle with my arms and rock her. She shouted, "Sal! A worm!" and held up a lob worm she'd found. Lobworms are very good bait for perch and brown trout, and are unusual in acid soils like the area we are surviving in. Peppa skipped back across the rocks and onto the big stone out in the lock and held the worm over the water. She called across to me, "See if you'll take it," and she dangled the end of it into the water from her fingertips. I was just going to say there was no point without a hook, when there was a swirl in the water and splash under the worm, and Peppa shouted, "Bastard!" And she looked over at me with her eyes wide and her mouth open. "He took it! He was a big one, Sal! Get another worm!" For the first time since we came here, I missed my phone. I wish I could have filmed her squatting in the sun on that rock and that flat glass water and beaming and looking happy. I decided to remember it there and then in my mind, in case it didn't happen again. The sun was on her face and she called across, "Nice here, innit?" And I said, "Aye." And I jumped up onto the grass and started pulling the tussocks up to find a worm. It took ages, and the one I found under a rock was flat and reddish, and I don't know what species it was. I jumped out on the wee stones and jumped up next to her on the rock, and now she was an expert, and she took the worm and went on in her sing-song voice. "And you just dangle it like this, and the wee fishy sees his tail in the water." And I said, "Was he spotty or stripy?" She said, "Spotty. Gold and big red spots. What's that?" "Brown trout," I said. "Can you eat it?" "Aye, we can catch them with spinners too." "Oh, should have brought the rod. Why does he eat spinners?" "He doesn't eat them. He thinks they're prey." "But they're metal." "Aye, but they flash and they look like wee fish when you spin them." She turned her head and stared at me. "You know everything," she said. "Aye, I do," I said. But the big trout didn't come back, so we dropped the worm in down the side of the rock and watched a wee perch dart out and take it. This would be a good place for fishing, and we would come back tomorrow with the rod. We started back up the slope with the sun high above us. Peppa walked until we came up to the clearing in the bracken where the grass was greenest and thick, and we'd set a snare. Two rabbits sprang out of the grass in front of us and tore off up towards the warren, and Peppa took off after them. I watched her springing along through the fern with the rabbits, two brown blurs in front of her and their white arses flashing. Then Peppa stopped dead and shouted back to me that there was a rabbit in the snare we set. She went, "Sal! Sal, look at it!" I sprinted up onto the clearing. It was a big long one, caught perfect round the throat and bucking and jerking against the cord and the peg. Peppa said, I chased him in. I saw him go in.
There's blood.
A dark ring of blood was emerging from the throat, where the snare wire was clenched tight like a ball. The blood started spraying and flicking in drops on me as the rabbit bucked, and I knelt down next to it. I have never killed anything apart from Robert, but I wasn't bothered about it. This was going to be our first kill surviving, and I'd seen it done loads of time on telly and YouTube. I grasped the rabbit round the throat and lifted it, tugging the snare peg up. It was letting out a high scream, like air hissing. I squeezed the neck and the snare bow and felt warm blood flood out onto my fingers. Then I got its back legs that were kicking and caught them in my other hand, and I pulled as hard as I could and felt a crack under my fingers, round the throat, and the rabbit hissed and went stiff and then flopped. Peppa said, "Fuck me." And I said, "Don't swear." I dropped the rabbit down on the grass and it jerked once when it hit the ground and then went still. It was a big buck. Plenty of meat and a great first snare for us. I felt brilliant. Peppa stroked its fur. She said, "He's warm. Is it a boy or a girl?" "Buck or a doe," I said. "Aye, buck or a doe." "A buck, and he's going to be your tea." "I chased him in, didn't I not?" "He did, aye. You herded him like the Sioux with buffalo." "Did I? Tell me about them." "I'll tell you stuff later, tonight, when we go to bed." She said, "Okay." We walked back up the slope towards the thicker woods and the burn, and I held the rabbit by his legs. And he was heavy. Then I remembered. You've got to DP them. So I held him by his head and ran my hand down his side and over his stomach, and the pee came out from between his legs in a dribble. Chapter 2. Shots. That afternoon, I made a barrier to go behind the fire and reflect heat back towards the shelter, and Peppa practiced with the slingshot after she had finished the Belvitas. With a Bear Grylls knife, you can either use the serrated sawing blade to cut wood, or you can use a stone as a hammer and hit the blunt side of the blade into a branch at the bottom until it's mostly cut through, and then rip it off. I used 11 branches from birch for the uprights and cut points into the end and then hammered them in with a stone until they were about a metre high. Then I wove branches in between, mostly smaller birch, some alder and some hazel sticks from a pollarded hazel by the burn. The barrier was curved and ran along the front of the shelter, about 2 metres back from where we slept on a raised bed made from birch and alder poles and covered with spruce branches, which made a very soft bed, and they also insulated, and they smell nice. Peppa collected small round stones from the burn and used them as ammo to practice with the slingshot. I explained the principle of trajectory to her, which is that as the speed of the projectile drops, the force of gravity comes to bear on it, and it falls at a given rate per metre that it is travelling with the fall rate directly related to the speed. So the slower it gets, the faster it falls. If you can work out at what point at a given distance the projectile starts to drop, then you can make a basic estimate of its eventual position in relation to the target. So that means you can adjust your firing position relative to the target so it's going at a maximum speed when it hits it. Or you can alter the angle of the aim up or down to make the projectile go in a rising, then falling trajectory towards the target. This means you can stand further away and calculate the angle you need to hit the target. but the further away you stand, the higher the aim angle needs to be, and the less velocity the projectile will have when it hits the target. So I told Peppa all this about the slingshot and trajectories, and she looked at me and frowned and then said, "Righty-ho, Sal," and started firing stones at the Belvita box. There is an optimum distance from target you can eventually find, which ensures the necessary velocity for a kill. The least falling trajectory and the necessary distance from an animal or a bird so you don't scare it. I told Peppa to try and find that. I thought if the stone punctured the cardboard of the Belvita box, then that was probably enough power to kill a rabbit, or a pheasant, or a grouse, from whatever distance she was shooting from. She said, "Could this kill a deer?" And I said, "No, because you'd never be able to get close enough to it for the stone to have the necessary power. Deer have hard skulls. Even if you went for a neck shot, it would be unlikely to pierce it." I wondered if Robert's air gun would kill a deer. It would go through 9mm plywood on 10 pumps at a distance of about 20 metres, and I should think that that would go through a roe deer skull, and it would definitely go through the neck. But I'm not sure you could get that close to a deer unless you sat silent downwind for a long time. Most deer rifles are 30-06 or 30-30 calibre, which is a very high-speed bullet, and it maintains its power over very long distances, like up to a kilometre. And it is a real bullet powered by a cartridge and explosives. But Robert's rifle is only a .22 air gun, and the muzzle velocity is restricted by law, so you would have to get really close. But I thought I might try. A deer would provide meat for several days, and they don't hibernate. And I fancied getting camouflaged and stalking one. Ed Stafford caught one, in some woods in Poland or somewhere like that he was surviving in, with a snare made from a bent-over sapling that triggered and strangled the deer. He skinned it and used the skin for a jumper, and he buried the meat in a pit fire to cook it, and he hung a load up over the fire, so bears didn't get it. There are no bears in the Galloway Forest, so we didn't have to worry about that. And I thought I might have a go at making that snare in a few days, when we were properly settled in, and we knew nobody was looking for us. I collected more wood for the fire. I got dead branches, mostly off trees or leaning up off the ground because they are the driest. I made a long pile the length of the shelter and stacked another pile next to it to dry and use later. Then I got birch bark for tinder and used the flint and steel to make a spark and blew it until I got a flame and fed in dry grass and twigs and got it going. I used burning twigs to start two more points at the end and in the middle so it would all burn along its whole length. Even after a few minutes, I could feel the heat bouncing off the barrier when I sat on the raised bed. Then I gutted the rabbit, and although I had never done it before, I had watched it done loads of times, and it was easy. And I kept the liver, heart and kidneys for fishing bait, because they are good for eels. To skin a rabbit first, you cut off the head and the paws. Then you pull the skin down each leg until they pop out, and then you drag the whole lot back up the body slowly until it all comes off in a winner. Most of the meat on a rabbit is on the legs and the haunches, so I cut it in half and put some McDonald's salt in it, and I laid it on a big flat stone over the fire. Then I went down to the burn and washed my hands because of infections and food poisoning. I had seen a video of Inuit women in Alaska curing and stretching skins on around frames made from alder saplings, so I cut a long one and made a circular hoop about a metre diameter and bound it with paracord. Then I laid out the skin and made a series of little holes around its perimeter with the Bear Grylls knife. Then I threaded paracord through one, then over the frame, then back down through the next one all the way around until the skin was stretched out across the whole frame. When I was doing this, sitting by the fire and with the sun starting to go down and the northerly breeze picking up, making my fingers cold, and the smell of the fire and it crackling and popping, I felt for a minute like I had always done this. I had always been able to thread a rabbit skin onto a frame, and this wasn't the first time. It felt funny, and I couldn't remember for a minute if I had ever done it, or if I had only seen them doing it on YouTube. And for a minute, or for a few seconds really, I felt a bit dizzy, and I could only see my hands threading the cord through the skin and over the hoop and back through the skin and back over the hoop and pulling it tighter. I couldn't feel the fire on my legs or the cold on my hands or hear the crackles or pepper shooting at the Belvita box. I could only see my hands and the thread and the little holes in the skin and the dark bark on the alder hoop and my hands moving like it wasn't me. Like I was a big eye watching it. And behind the big eye was a big black space. And I was peering out from an eye-shaped hole in it, at my hands, threading the cord through the skin and over the hoop. And then I came back. And I was still threading the cord. And the rabbit was starting to sizzle on the stone. And Peppa came running over with a slingshot and Belvita box and said, "I can hit it, but it just dents it. Look." And she showed me the little dents and dinks in the yellow cardboard. We turned the rabbit over and put more salt on it, and it smelled lovely, and it was going brown and gold like toffee and hissing. The fire was getting really hot, and Peppa laid out on the bed and took off her Helly Hansen and trainers and joggy bottoms and stretched out in her knickers and vest and went, "Ah, lovely warm. These are prickly, Sal," patting the pine branches. The rabbit tasted good, and it was all cooked through, and Peppa ate most of it. But I had a leg and a lot of meat from off the top along the spine they call the saddle. It is good to eat freshly killed and cooked meat because it contains small amounts of vitamin C, which you need so you don't catch scurvy, which makes your teeth fall out and you go mad. Old sailors and people on Arctic expeditions used to get it before they started eating lemons, which have a lot of vitamin C in them. And so does kale and red peppers. But I also had multivitamins for us so we didn't get scurvy or other illnesses caused by vitamin deficiencies like osteoporosis, osteopenia and gout. We boiled water from the burn in the kettle and had tea with McDonald's milk and sugar. We had a mug each. They were enamel and mine was blue and Peppa's was green. I banked up the fire with new wood all along and Peppa jumped up and ran down behind the shelter to do a wee and a poo, and the latrine had dug out with a stick on the first day we got here. She went barefoot and came hopping back going, "Oh, it's fucking cold." The latrine was the first thing I made when we got to this site. It's about 7 metres away from the shelter, down from it in case it rains, but close enough so you can still see the fire glow from it. But it is black out there behind you when you are going and you have to face the shelter so you can see the fire and not think about the black behind you. You wipe your bum on grass. I had cut a big bunch of it and put it by the latrine on a flat rock where you can see it and it will dry a bit. It was probably only about 6:30, but Peppa climbed into the double sleeping bag on the bed and I took my shoes off and took off my fleece and got in with her and she wriggled and went, "Ooh, it's cosy." We had two blankets as well. One was a fleece blanket from IKEA and one was an old pink pure wool blanket with a satin edge I brought from the flat where it had been in the airing cupboard for years and nobody used it. The rabbit skin on the frame was lying flat on the damp leaves with the skin down and the fur up. I didn't want it to dry out because tomorrow I was going to scrape all the bits of meat and fat off it and then cure it with wood ashes and whey and oak leaves, which have got tannin in them, and they are meant to make the skin soft and supple. Inuit women chew the skin side and mash it all up with spit to stop it drying hard and snaggy. The chewing breaks down the skin tissue, and I think spit must preserve it too, because that is how they cure skins and furs. But you can make it soft with whey and ashes and oak leaves, where you make a paste and spread it on and let it soak in for a few days. And that preserves it according to a site I looked up about curing skins and furs. I didn't know if it would work or not. Peppa went on the fire side and I went on the tarp side. But I was really warm even though the wind was getting up again and swishing the last leaves on the birch trees. But it must have shifted from north because it wasn't coming in from the top like the night before. It was hitting the back of the tarp and making it billow in and out. So it was probably a westerly or northwesterly. But I didn't have my compass to check, and I was starting to feel very sleepy. Peppa said, "Tell me about the Sioux and the buffalo." She likes me to tell her stuff every night, and I like it too. Sometimes I have to make stuff up if I don't know all the correct facts and dates and places, but I don't tell her because she thinks I know everything. And mostly I do. Especially about the Sioux and the Buffalo and the Indian Wars of the 1860s and the Great Plains. So I told her about how the Dakota Sioux migrated to the Great Plains in the 18th century and built a culture based on hunting the millions of buffalo that lived on the plains and herds so big a man could ride past one for a whole day and not see bare ground. And how the braves would ride alongside the herds and use their horses to split off small groups and drive them away across the plains towards a cliff edge where they would all run over and be killed in their hundreds on the rocks below. It was the most dangerous way of hunting the buffalo, and that was why they did it, because a brave could show his courage and skill on a horse, and one successful hunt in the autumn would provide food and shelter and clothing for the entire tribe for a whole winter. And the winters in the Great Plains were savagely cold, with feet of snow and freezing north winds. And when I got to this bit, Peppa was asleep, and I kissed her ear and made a spoon behind her, and listened to the wind and crackle of the fire with my eyes closed. Chapter 3. Hooks. When I woke up, I started to worry straight away that it was 4 days since we ran, and this was the 4th day here, and they would definitely be looking for us all over. I think it was our 4th day here. I think they would have found Ma in the room by now, and she had a phone so she could phone out. But the room was locked from the outside, and the key was on the carpet, and there was no way she could have killed Robert and then locked herself in there from the outside, so that proved she didn't do it. And they would have found Robert on my bed, and all the blood from his throat where I stabbed him 3 times. And blood up the wall too, on the wallpaper with monkeys on it. And Peppa gone too, and her room just normal. They didn't know about the school uniforms we wore, or the rucksack, or the backpack Peppa carried, or the hockey stick case with the gun and the rod in it. So if they looked for things missing, they wouldn't know what was and wasn't there. I knew what was there and what we'd taken, but the police and social workers wouldn't know that. They'd find my T-shirt and jeans and knickers with Robert's blood all over them in the washing and the bathroom, so they'd know it was me. They'd find the lock on Peppa's unlocked door and the key on the floor, so they'd know I locked her in and it wasn't her. I wondered if Ma had gone on telly asking us to come back and saying we weren't in any trouble, or if they thought I had kidnapped Peppa. And they wouldn't find the knife because I had it with me. I got rid of all the phones I used to look stuff up, and I dumped the laptop and I skipped the day before I did it. I threw the phones off the wall into the sea where it is deep even at low tide and you go spinning for mackerel. They would also find the phones Robert got and brought back, and the cards he had, and they knew him anyway, because he'd been in jail once, and he had a court appearance coming up in November for theft. They'd find bits of weed and speed and Mandy all over the place, and they'd know it was Robert's. And they had been to our flat twice 2 years ago, once when Robert was hitting Ma and me, and once when Ma nicked 2 bottles of vodka from Spar and got seen with them walking up to the flats and somebody shopped her. If the police were clever, they'd trace the things I bought on the stolen cards over the 8 months when I was planning it. But I'd put all those cards back in Robert's drawer, or chucked them, and most of them had been cancelled by the time I tried to use them. But if one copper was clever enough to look at the purchases on stolen cards from Robert, he'd see all the stuff I bought on Amazon, like a tarp and a compass and the knife and mess tins and Peppa's trainers and the rucksack. And if he thought about it, he might have had an idea what I was going to do. But coppers are not that clever, and most of them I've met or seen on the telly are really thick, and they don't arrest the people they should, and they do arrest the people they shouldn't. When they came round when Robert was hitting Ma, the woman copper asked Ma if she was all right, and Ma said, aye, and it was just a rammy and shouting and no hitting. And the woman copper said to her, are you absolutely sure? And Ma said, aye. The man copper had taken Robert in the other room when she said this to Ma, and she didn't ask me anything, but I wouldn't have told her anyway, because they'd bring the social in and we'd get split up. Peppa was watching telly. You could hear everything in our flats. A guy called Big Chris lived above us. He sometimes bought weed and Mandy off Robert. At night you could hear him banging and screaming and crying. I don't know why. We nicked his broadband most of the time because Robert got his Wi-Fi code. Robert got phones and sims too. Some of them could get 4G. I mostly went to McDonald's to get online when I was buying stuff with the cards. I used to go get a McFlurry and sit facing the door so I could see who was coming in. I got the school uniforms from a charity shop in August. They were two blazers and skirts and ties and blouses, and mine was a bit tight, but Peppa's fitted her. I paid £10 for them and told the wifey in the shop they were for a school play. They were from a posh school in Glasgow and had gold and red badges with Ad Vitam embroidered on them. That means for life in Latin. We both wore our walking trainers with them and they looked all right. And I carried the rucksack and the hockey stick case and Peppa carried the backpack. And we left the flat at 6 a.m. and nobody saw us. And we went through the close, the back way, and up the alley and climbed over the fence onto the path by the park that led along to the train station. So we didn't even walk on any roads or places where people would be. And we got the 6:15 to Glasgow and I bought the tickets in the machine with the cash from Robert's wallet. I worried on the train and in Glasgow that we'd see kids who went to the posh school in real life and they'd know we didn't go to their school and they'd remember us. But we didn't. In Glasgow, where we changed trains, it was crowded and there were hundreds of people all over, rushing and walking and talking on phones, and nobody even looked at us. When we got on the train to Girvan, there was only one old wifey in the carriage and she smiled at Peppa. It was like she was going, "Oh, she looks so sweet." I just wanted people to see two nice, posh little girls going on a train to a posh school. And they did. Peppa asked if we had to talk posh if we talked. And I said no. Don't talk till we get to the forest. But if the police issued descriptions, Mob would tell them what we would be wearing. And then people would look for two girls wearing those things and not school uniforms like we were. If they saw us on CCTV, we'd be two posh girls in school uniforms, not two schemies from our flats. And I told Peppa to look down all the time at the station so they didn't see our faces. With the sleeping bag and the blankets and the lures and the spinners and the kettle standing kettle, the rucksack was heavy. But it was properly packed and had a waist strap, so once it was on it was easy to walk with. Peppa carried most of the food in her backpack and also the first aid kit and spare paracord and the slingshot and some fishing stuff and air gun pellets. At Girvan we went in a cafe by the station and Peppa had a big Scottish breakfast and I had bacon and egg and sausage and toast. The man in the cafe just said, "There you go, girls," when he brought the food, and that was all he said. And we paid and then got the X22 to Newton Stewart, which goes all the way along the edge of the Galloway Forest Park. I had to get the map and keep checking for our stop, and I rang the bell when we were near it, by a village called Glentrill, and the bus stopped and we got off, and the driver didn't even look at us. Then we walked up a little road towards the village, and when we came to a green wooden sign that said Galloway Forest Park, we went into the car park and walked along a path through some pine woods. We went into the woods and changed our clothes and buried the school uniforms and the two phones we had. I took the batteries and the sims out and put them in a bin in the car park because phone batteries have lithium in them which could leak out and cause pollution in the soil. Then we climbed a bit and the path came round and out and we were looking down a valley towards Loch Trull. And there were mountains with forest going up either side, and far away at the end on the other side was a bit that stuck out into the loch called the Bruce's Stone, where Robert the Bruce lived and fought the English with a gang of men in 1307. He had lived wild in the hills and slept in caves and shelters. It was all lit up with sunshine, and from the height of the sun, and working out the times we'd been on the train and bus and walking, I reckoned it was only just before 11 o'clock in the morning. And the night before, I had killed Robert and locked Ma in her room. I could feel the start of the glow of the sun through the trees, but it was still dark and Peppa was fast asleep. It was really cold and there was frost on the burned edges of the sticks in the fire and the whole length of it was dusty ash, but I could see some smoke coming from the middle where there were lumps like charcoal. The stone we cooked the rabbit on was split into three flat ovals that looked like roof slates, like we'd sliced it. I thought they'd make good plates. We had two head torches and a solar charger, but I was trying to get used to the dark and seeing, and the more you sit in the dark, the easier it gets to see. Even in pitch black, you can sense things like animals do. And I'm not scared of the dark, and neither is Peppa. At night here, it is so black, and there is so little light pollution from towns and cars, you can see the Milky Way, and the stars give you a bit of light to see by, even if there is no moon. It's only glow, and not proper light, and it starts to go down before the sun comes up, and that is one way you can tell when dawn will be, if the sky is clear. The wind was picking up now. It was a cold one. I slid out of the sleeping bag and found my trainers and joggers and pulled them on. I zipped my fleece up and then blew the embers back to the glowing and started a little fire with three half-burned twigs. I crumbled some dry birch bark on it and it fizzed and cracked and gave me more flame. Then I